Hello, everyone. Welcome to Everything is Gay, Even the Straight Stuff, Christmas Edition, Part One. Hello, Magnus.
Hello. How are we this festive season?
Putting the ho 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 in holidays. Not just one ho, but three. Like the wise men.
Oh. a brilliant connection. And oh, yes. Well, as you know, I typically put a lot of ho into everything, so the season shall be no exception.
Yes, I love the holidays. Actually, almost all movies with the title Holiday I Love In. So every time we talk about Christmas-themed movies, I get really excited and I get almost overwhelmed with choices. And so actually this particular film is connected to one of my other favorite holiday films, which is not as well rated as it should be. But before I tell you what this movie is, I want to tell you what was stipulated in order to make this movie happen, that the people that pitched this movie had to provide in order to make this movie happen. This is kind of incredible.
You've fully intrigued me, so please do tell.
Yes, and so bear in mind, this is the 1998 money, so this is however many years ago. You had to be willing to pay $5 million, give 4% of the box office gross, 50% of merchandising revenue and music-related material, 70% of the income from book tie-ins. The lead actor had to be comparable to Jack Nicholson, Jim Carrey, Robin Williams, or Dustin Hoffman. And the director or writer of this film could not have earned less than $1 million on a previous picture.
And sorry, who was stipulating this to whom?
So Dr. Seuss, because we're going to talk about the live action Grinch today. So Dr. Seuss basically refused ever to sell the film rights to his books. After his death, his widow, Audrey, who was, I believe, his second wife, did agree to several merchandising deals. But in 1998, she was kind of ready to sell for the Grinch. Because they had that really special animated version of it. And so they were ready to make a live action one. This is one of two live action pictures. It is also the second highest grossing. No, it's third now. So it was, after Home Alone, it was the second highest grossing holiday film up until the 2018 Grinch, which for some reason made a lot of money. But up until that point, up until 2018, Live Action Grinch was the second highest grossing holiday movie of all time, which I can understand why, even though Roger Ebert absolutely hated it. I think there's a lot of really good stuff in this film. It was actually really important to Ron Howard to expand the character of Cindy Lou Who, to really bump the materialistic representation of the Whos. And to basically flesh out what essentially is an epic poem into something much bigger in the form of a live action movie. And I really love this film personally.
That's quite interesting. I didn't realize about all the stipulations involved in the creation of this film. Although one would say that those kind of stipulations probably did go some way to making sure the production was taken as seriously as it should have been. Because if you've got someone that's bargaining hard on it, you're going to pay more attention, shall we say. And certainly, well, actor equivalent to Jim Carrey, well, I'd say that they did. They got
they
the good
equivalent.
Well.
Although yes. Jim didn't have as good a time on it in the beginning, because it's quite famously known that getting into that Grinch makeup was incredibly difficult. I can't believe they're actually doing a sequel for it. The sequel was pitched in 2023. So they are doing a sequel to this, but it quite famously getting into that Grinch movie makeup like nearly destroyed him, and he had to like learn interrogation techniques so that he could actually remain calm in that makeup, because basically it's like being buried alive in prosthetics, and I can't even imagine doing that every day, because takes 2 hours to put on, takes an hour to get off, and then you have all the filming to do while doing it. I can't even imagine it, really.
But you have, Jim has always been quite the dedicated actor for his roles and such. He's always been the sort to really embrace a challenge, as it were. I remember him from, oh god, this is going way back, his Ace Ventura days, The Mask days. Oh, what was the gay flick he did? I Love You something something.
I Love You, Philip Morris.
That's
was,
it.
Was that one, I believe, yes.
In terms of embracing stuff, he really goes full hog into it. I believe he could be, even though he seems to be in quite a bit, I think he has, over the years, been quite selective with what he has chosen. I think if he likes a film, that's what he's going to go for. I think he just doesn't take on any old thing. Do you get that impression?
Well, yeah, and he comes from not an SNL tradition, but an In Living Color tradition. So his work is a little more physical, a little more shocking. Mm. It's slightly old school. Even his, even when he does dramatic roles, like I believe it was like Room 23, he really does add a physical component to his work. And you can see that here. But basically here, he almost had to do like mime Commedia dell'arte work, because even though it's a Grinch prosthetic and he still talks, that takes over your whole face. You have to do it almost as much in your body as you do in your face, because otherwise you're going to miss everything.
You could almost argue that his sort of brand of physical humor is a bit of an evolutionary offshoot from slapstick and such, and sort of the more physical humor from prior times. I'm thinking Laurel and Hardy and such, and it's not quite like their brand, but you could certainly see the resemblance in some aspects.
I could see him doing like a Buster Keaton type thing. I could see him doing that kind of physical, the house falls, but the window is right where it lands, so you don't get hurt sort of thing. Yeah. There was a tradition of that for a long time in Hollywood, and it's just something that, with CGI especially, you get away from. We see a little bit in Marvel movies especially, because they have to be, you have to be built to do a superhero movie. You don't really have a choice about it. But it's,
that's one way of putting it.
It's one way of putting it. But it is kind of, I mean, really, his contemporaries now, the only real contemporary is left that I can think of off the top of my head would be like Mr. Bean. And Mr. Bean's not even really his contemporary. There's just not a lot of people that I can think of doing that sort of physical. Maybe it's just not in vogue right now, and it'll come back in about 10 years. But like when I look on Instagram or TikTok for people talking about comedic things, it's a lot of sitcoms, very static, very dialogue driven. So there really aren't people doing kind of that slapstick work that I can think of at the top of my head that are like current to what we do. So
yes, but anyway, back to the Grinch, my dear boy.
Yeah,
the subject at hand. And
that was pretty on subject though, because Jim Carrey is a big part of this film. You can't have a Grinch movie without a Grinch.
This is true. Although having looked through the cast list, I can see there's a bit of a who's who of Hollywood talent in this film.
I'm not surprised, because once they got Ron Howard behind it, Ron Howard was really big in 2000. Brian Grazer was really big in 2000. Price and Seaman, who did the screenplay, were also responsible for Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So anyone that was a fan of Bob Hoskins would have seen their name attached and definitely wanted to work with it. Having Christine Baranski and Molly Shannon in the same room makes me really happy. I think Bill Irwin as the dad is pretty underrated in his performance. Actually, everyone that was working behind the scenes has like a cameo in the film, according to the Wikipedia, which is super cool. Taylor Momsen is the only one that really didn't do much after this. And of course, Jeffrey Tambor has had some really niche roles off and on after this film, obviously. So,
Yes. It's only one that it's only one of those films that you end up watching, and all of a sudden you have a sort of, oh, I recognize you
Yeah.
moment with some of these people.
I mean, Christine Bransky, you can put prosthetics on her and give her a new nose, but she's still Christine Bransky. She has a very distinctive face, so it's not I love that they made her a little sexy. I love that they did a Who that was a little bit of a bombshell Who, which is just not something that you necessarily get from the book. I like that. One of the things I love about this, and they did win an award for costume design, I believe. But one of the things I love was how distinct they made, like Universal, where they did all the backlot stuff. So most of this isn't CGI, most of this is like physical stuff. They really went all in on making the town of Whoville seem very Christmas-fied, but very different. Almost all of the costumes give a little bit of information about the people, and I very much appreciate how diverse it was in a way. Not incredibly diverse. They're pretty white cast, really, if you think about it, but in their clothing styles, at least, there's something really diverse about how they dressed them, and I really appreciate that.
You mentioned about diversity. Might be a good time to bring up one little point. Certainly one of the main themes of this flick is it's sort of like very much the majority with and the other, and how the majority react to the other, and the sort of the repercussions of like treating people that are different to you, and what it unfortunately leads to. And I think it re like the sort of the twists and turns that we do see within this film is sort of like the Grinch is invited back into the town through Cindy's efforts, and then sort of re-experiences his trauma and such. You
Yeah.
know, realistically, what the whole thing with the Grinch, it's very much, it isn't like the whole town, although they did do some stuff as a town to terrorize him, but they really did cause the situation in the first place, so I'm glad that it was able to be resolved in the end.
Yeah. Oh, what's interesting is that this is wholly new Grinch origin material, by the way.
Yes.
So the original story of the Grinch from the Seussian logic, in the original Grinch Who Stole Christmas, they didn't give any backstory because that's not how it works as kind of the short story poem. But Grinch is just basically one from a race of Grinches, and the more Grinch mythology you get, the more it's just, no, that's just how the race is. They're all just kind of grumpy. There's actually a Grinch cartoon that was done once where Grinch's mom tries to get him to be evil again. Like she like shows up in a mirror, if I remember correctly. And so it's really he the Grinches is just a race of beings that are kind of grumpy like that. But then again, if I was trying to sleep and people woke me up with a lot of music, maybe I'd be grumpy still. Because I mean, even living way up on Mount Crumpet, like their music is still getting to him. And of course, the opening dialogue where it's like, hey, they live in a snowflake. There's only so many places you can go on a snowflake. Even if you're very tiny, it's still a snowflake.
Very, very true. And you briefly mentioned in passing the fact that they've greenlit for a sequel. Was it a sequel to this one or the 2018 version?
It's a sequel to this, which kind of intrigues me. There's no information about it yet, and it was just greenlit like in July. So there's probably nothing down on paper yet, I guess, because they just got done having all of the protests, not protests. They just got done having
The
all of
the strike.
the strike, yeah. So they don't necessarily, I guess I could see it being, I mean, what they could do, they could do go the Turning Red route, and it has to do with the Grinch teaching their kids how to be other. Like if they bring the Grinch and Christine Baranski back and they have kids and they go through the generational trauma and they show the other Grinches, like that would be a pretty That would be in line with what we're seeing in a lot of kind of like Pixar Disney stuff right now, especially Pixar. Pixar is making Inside Out 2. That's the next motion picture. So I would not be surprised if that's the way they went, but I don't know, because the Grinch story for all effects and purposes kind of ends here. So I don't know what you would do for a sequel, really.
You see,
To be interesting enough, you know.
So I was going to ask you about, because you mentioned some other Grinch lore and such. I was going to ask you, in your opinion, whether this other lore was enough really to give something for the sequel, or is it just
There
not?
is. Halloween is Grinch's night, which is kind of trippy. There was a Mother's Day Grinch cartoon, which I fully believe the people that made it were on acid the whole time. There is a weird subset of Grinch cartoons where it's like the Grinch versus Cab in the Hat or Roadrunner Wile E. Coyote type fashion. But those are
Oh,
all predicated on the
okay.
idea that the Grinch is like not just kind of grouchy, but is like outright evil in a lot of ways, like with like very redeeming value. So they either have to retcon the Grinch completely and they have to take him away from Whoville,
Okay.
or they have to figure out, because with this origin story, it is so different from what we know of the Grinch. It basically says that he got adopted into the Whos, and so already there, unless they're going to send him on a like Winnie the Pooh Tigger-like adventure to find other Grinches, they can't really use the mythology of it. They'd have to go outside of that, and I don't think that's bad, especially if they get Ron Howard again, or if they get Price and Seaman, because Price and Seaman took Roger Rabbit, and they did something extraordinary with it. So I don't know who's attached to the project. I just have a hard time seeing based on how. Based on how tight this movie is, not just to the original story, but how it wraps up all of its plot threads, it would have to be about the Grinch and the Grinch's kids and generational. I can't imagine doing another story and having it not be about the Grinch battling his own generational trauma. I don't know what else he would do. I don't know.
Generational trauma does seem to be sort of the buzzword trend of the moment. I mean, Luca, Encanto, could definitely pull up a few more examples, like Turning Red. You mentioned as well. And I think that's good. That's good. But as you say, what else could they really do? And I suppose my other question is, would they do Christmas again? I suppose Grinch and Christmas are quite closely connected, but
You have to do a winter holiday because this version of Whoville is on a snowflake. So it at least has to be a holiday somewhere where there is a snowflake. See, that's what's great. That's the great thing about having your narrator be Anthony Hopkins, is that you're going to remember the snowflake thing. But again, that mythology only exists for this movie. So it has to at least be set in winter. So either it's going to be a real snowy Halloween, a real snowy Thanksgiving, a real snowy New Year's. I don't know. I think there's something about the iconography of the Grinch in the fake Santa Claus outfit that he makes for himself. There's also this movie. The soundtrack to this movie is so much of its time in 2000. Like one of the songs is done by NSYNC or several members of NSYNC. Faith Hill is like the main headliner on this. Busta Rhymes, Bare Naked Ladies, Green Christmas song. Like, if you're gonna do this and do a 2023 version, you're gonna have to have like Taylor Swift on there and Lorde, if Lorde is still making music. And I guess you could do like, if you do like an Orville Peck song, I think Orville Peck would do a really interesting like Grinch song. I wouldn't be mad about that. But yeah, this soundtrack is very much of 2000, and that doesn't make it bad, but it's just very much like this was really
Of its
in its
time.
of its time, and that's not bad, but it's also like the Addams Family soundtrack. The movie's great. The soundtrack is very much of its time.
But you could argue, you could almost argue from the perspective of that just helps solidify the Grinch having a solid identity. Right. And that's great. I on a little quick tangent, I just thought of another thing that they could do as a sequel. They could do one of those versus movies, you know, Grinch versus Krampus, evil Grinch comes to steal Christmas and our Grinch has to fight back. Grinch versus Jack Frost. Some, you know, some of that could be another way they do it, but
Yeah, Grinch has done the Cabin Hat thing where he did that, but the problem is that you have to send Grinch back to a time before Whoville changed him, because all of those verses were predicated on the Cabin Hat being this very joyful anarchistic soul and like really just bugging the Grinch until the Grinch had to fight back. Quite famously, when Audrey what's her name? When Audrey Geisel came to visit set, one of the things that she kind of said she did not want that they took out of the film was in the Grinch cave, he had like a stuffed Cat in the Hat head on his wall, like a trophy. And she was like, "No, we can't have that. No, we can't have that." And I guess they took that out, which I think would add quite a bit of dimension to that. What's interesting now is that Tim Burton's probably not busy. So he could probably direct it this time because originally he was going to be part of this film, but he was busy doing Sleepy Hollow, which is a fabulous movie in its own right. So he could not be part of this. But I got to tell you, if they got Tim Burton on it, if they could do Tim Burton without going like over stylized, I would be interested to see what Tim would do for a sequel.
Yes, that'd be interesting. And we mentioned about like the original cast and such, and it does make me wonder how many of them, if any, will come back, whether they will just bring in younger actors to show that not too much time has passed.
Yeah, I mean, Josh Ryan Evans wouldn't be coming back because he's passed away and he's the one that played the 8-year-old Grinch. Jim Carrey definitely probably would. Taylor Momsen, and I keep seeing that she has left Hollywood, so I don't know if she would or not. But if you are aging up Cindy Lou Who to like teenage years, you could easily find like one of the Euphoria kids who could probably do it or something like that. Jeffrey Tambor is still around, although he's kind of not as highly regarded as he was then. I love Christine Baranski. I would see her in anything. Of course, you love Christine Baranski because we both watched the Mamma Mia movies. They'd probably have to bring back Bill Irwin and Molly Shannon as Louie and Betty, which I would think. And if Anthony Hopkins is still around for it, I'd hope they bring him back as the narrator. But a lot of the second or third tier characters are almost all cameos or have one line, like Deep Roy had like one line. So the cast is really small enough that you could, but like you could bring in other characters from Who Canon. You could bring in Horton, you could bring in the Lorax potentially if you wanted to go, because there is an environmental message to this version of the Grinch. As much as it's about othering, it's about over-consumerism and basically lives at the dump. So you could easily bring in like something like the Lorax into Whoville potentially, because they kind of had that message. It's a little bit of the message, so you really could expand that in the second one. But then, is it too much of a heavy-handed message? I guess is the question.
Oh God, I was just thinking that this is the way that you were describing it. It feels like it's going down very much an expanded universe
Yeah.
route. We're going to have the Seuss multiverse.
I mean,
Cinematography in hand.
after the Cat in the Hat movie in 2003, nobody would touch a Seuss property. But if they're doing a second Grinch, it is a chance to reboot because you do have some Grinch characters like the Sneetches, where you have a group of Grinch characters that get stars on their belly and a group that don't, and it's a way to openly talk about it's not subtle, it's openly about racism. And so it's a question of you have all these characters in the Seuss universe that are about community and invention and being weird. But you've also got like hop on pop type things. So you have this world full of characters. And this is one thing, they did a Susian TV show that ran for a couple of seasons in the early 90s, where it was all kind of puppetry. And you really got to see how big the Seuss world is. And so there are options to bring in things like the Sneetches that are not known properties as much. There's a lot of ways to go with it. That the problem is that now you can't really, unless you're gonna retcon the Grinch can be a little sarcastic and dark, but he can't be full evil. He has to be like anti-hero in a way. Like you can still do kind of that steampunk thing, but he has to be kinder. So you don't have anywhere to go with his character. It has to be about either his kids or it has to be a threat to the town. So in a way it loses some of its value potentially. It's so hard to say what you'd do for a sequel. Unless the first scene is like someone brainwashing the Grinch, I guess that could be a thing you could do. There are enough people with technological abilities that you could brainwash the Grinch and turn him evil again. But would Jim Carrey want to do that? Would be then a question that I would have.
Yeah, would you want to actually go down that route? Yeah. Because it would sort of, as you say, it would sort of threaten to sort of go too back on what happened within the first Grinch film.
The other part of it is that I kind of am not looking forward to it because I'm afraid how much more CGI they're going to use. One of the things I love about this movie is it's such a physical film. When the Grinch, by the way, the scene where the Grinch has his like traumatic response and Jeffrey Tambor is just like pushing and pushing until he breaks, I always have to like go through that. Like I always have to fast forward through that because it's such a hard scene to watch because it's just like so visually traumatic. But what's great about that is that even with like the little toy cars, even with everybody in these strange colorful outfits, it's still very physically there. It's not CGI. And so that's the problem. Probably what I'm anticipating being a problem in 2023 is it's going to look more computerized, more slick. There's something about when you build an actual thing on a back lot and have a physical space that people have to move next to or move through. You have to put the snow down, so you get the idea of the holiday. If you don't have that, then it starts to lose a little bit of that value that I think actually brings a lot to this film.
There's an element of realism by having physical locations rather than just putting it on a green screen or what have you. And that actually brings it to a point I really did want to raise, which was you just mentioned about the Grinch reliving his trauma because he's getting pushed and such.
We all relive that trauma. This is a movie that if you have trauma, like there's like two or three scenes where it's like, Jesus Christ, this is a holiday film? I mean, the poor Taylor moms and a Cindy Lou Who, her mother takes all the lights from their house and puts them outside their house. So when she's doing Where Are You Christmas, she's in a completely dark house with a flashlight. Because her mom is so hell-bent on winning a Christmas light party that she puts all their... God, she puts the chandelier from the dining room on top of her freaking house.
Which, in all honesty, as much as that's like a very stark scene and it's a very... almost humorous as well with all that's going on, actually ties in neatly to the consumerism aspect. You know, the light shirt, the Christmas light wars that you'll see.
That is a deleted scene that when you watch it on TV, they did add that back in, is the rest of the Christmas light wars scene.
Ah, that's brilliant. I love it when you get those little bonus extras.
Yeah.
But so what I was trying to say with the trauma part was, for all the fantasy of this film, because it's fantasy, you know, it's a fantasy film, it's a Christmas film, all of this, despite how wildly imaginative it can get, it feels like the substance of the film is very much grounded within very real world experiences. Like, yeah, what the Grinch is going through, his reactions, you know, it's over the top, especially because, you know, it's a Seuss film. It's over the top, but then you feel for the poor thing and you understand where it's coming from. So all in all, it just really does. And like Cindy Lou trying to warn everyone against like getting caught up in the materialistic like aspect of Christmas, all of that, it, I think it makes it very relatable.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think there's something about having a character that lives outside of town in a cave and is basically the mythology of the town of being evil without any real reason for it. It's kind of this interesting, in 2000 it felt even more prescient than it does now, but in 2000 it did have a very queerness feeling to it, a very queerness other. Because I don't think people understand this, that I think I just need to let them know, because of the time that I was born in. There were families, there are still families that do this, that like won't invite their family members home for holiday dinners just because they're gay. Like there's no other way to put it. There is something othering about this. Like the one difference that keeps this from being a completely othered moment is the fact that the Grinch's adopted moms aren't also shunned by the town. But they also never go to try to find him, that I can tell. So there is an element of othering. It's a little softened by the fact that even though they are terrorized, it's really all, you know, straight white guy Jeffrey Tambor's fault. But the element of othering, the element of not being invited to be part of town, and then kind of egging that on for whatever reason. And in this film, it's interesting too, is that the Grinch doesn't just have the ability to sew a costume. The Grinch is actually amazing at like making stuff. Like he's almost a mechanical genius. You see him in a kid making the angel for Martha May Huvier, which is incredible. If you haven't seen this movie in a while, look at that like jeweled angel thing he makes from all this stuff in his parents' home. It's kind of incredible. Like if someone gave me that, I'd be like, I'd marry them right away, you know? But then he makes, they go through the scene, it's genius. He sings "You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch" while making his sled. It's kind of a genius change from the original. So instead of having Boris Karloff do the song while he's doing stuff, it's him singing it about himself while making the sleigh. And that's kind of incredible if you think about it. Like that's a really good change. That's a very simple thing, but it works really well.
You know, I just realized that the Grinch could be a sort of a two-sided analogy for. So the Grinch is capable of creating stuff. He's a mechanical genius, but he's able to make things of beauty when he's inspired. Almost like a Santa Claus-esque figure in being able to give someone a really good, heartfelt gift. Now, he's ostracized by this town, which feels about quite elfish at times. Like, you know, this town of like strange creatures living out in the snowy wilderness and such. So he goes to his cave and becomes an ostracized figure, almost like a Krampus-like figure. And in the film, it almost, when you think about it, and he wears the Santa suit at times as well, almost like he's switching back and forth between the two different depictions of Claus. Claus as a present giver, and Claus as Krampus punishing the naughty elves for what they've done. And I mean, I'm sorry if this is quite well known, and I'm just cottoning onto it now.
That's fine. No, there is an element of judgment to the Grinch. In a way, he's judging Whoville for their avarice and their consumerism, and he's like, All the stuff you get at Christmas is going to end up here at the dump anyways. Why don't I just do that for you already? There's something interesting in Othering, too, about Cindy Lou. It doesn't often work well to age up characters. So the idea of Cindy Lou Who, who's usually not more than two, the idea of Cindy Lou Who usually just has one scene. I can imagine in 2000, this might have been something really kind of provocative to do to make her like 9 or 10. The great thing about aging her up to like 9 or 10, however old she was supposed to be, is the idea that 9 or 10-year-olds are kind of forming their personality, but they're still respectful of authority in a lot of ways. It's like a pre-Harry Potter sixth grade phase. I don't know what the grade is for you, but sixth grade is like, no, sixth grade would be a little older. So it would be about fourth, fifth grade territory here in America. So.
And that was, how old? 10, 11?
Yeah, 10, 11 is like fifth grade. So 9, 10 is about fourth grade.
God, it's been as you might know, it's been a while since I was in school.
I thought you just graduated, heaven.
Oh, my twink-like appearance is still unchanged as ever. Yeah. But I think it's year six here for that age.
Yeah,
I could be completely wrong. Anyway, you were saying.
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting idea, and this was part of Ron Howard's kind of expansion of the Cindy Lou Hare character. Was taking in both the poem and in the animated special, the idea of this character who is the one character that the Grinch really kind of gives a pass to and connects with, partially because they're just too young to know really what the difference is or why he's doing it. So here's where you can start to see Ron Howard being able to suss out that the Grinch has something inside of him that he can use to create something for when the Grinch is in his first mean phase, is this idea of taking this character who is no more than two, who just wants a glass of water, who asks Santa Claus why he's taking their tree, and turn her into this character that is kind of got this Harriet the Spy, Veronica Mars vibe to her, who's really just trying to get to the truth, who's growing a little suspicious of the world, but doesn't know exactly how to face it. There's something kind of remarkable about Cindy Lou Who in like a self-actualized way. And I really enjoy that about this film, is that they flesh out, you know, the neighbors and they flesh out the family, but it doesn't really work if you don't have a good Cindy Lou. Like, it's great to have the fleshed out world, but without Cindy Lou Who, this movie doesn't work, because she continues to come back to the Grinch, and she continues to give him sort of not an adversary necessarily, I'm not sure what it would be classified as, but let's say adversary. Like, she continues to push him until he's pushed, but even after he's pushed, she still has the ability to see and forgive him. And there's something really great about Taylor Momsen's Cindy Lou Who character that I think should be honored. The more I think about it, the more I'm really glad that Ron Howard did that and became kind of intrigued by what Cindy Lou Who could actually do in a full Grinch picture. So yeah.
You could almost argue that they made a real effort to make sure that none of the characters were just a sort of a vehicle for the narrative to progress. Yeah. It could have been very easy to have throwaway characters just to like prompt certain key points and such. But I would argue it shows the attention to detail that they again came across from them being serious in making an actual proper feature and not just some sushi and cash grab, shall we say.
Yes, which was not something that Seuss really did, although he did grab plenty of cash, hopefully, when he was left. And though the movie is really funny, the humor never really seems out of place. There is the one Ricola joke in the beginning, which I don't think stands up very well, because they don't really do Ricola commercials anymore. But like the when he sees his adopted moms at the Cheermeister holiday bash or whatever, his first words are, "You two are still alive?" And that's kind of incredible. And also, interestingly enough, seeing them doesn't bring up his trauma. He is annoyed, but he's not traumatized by seeing his parents, which is really cool. That's a really cool kind of line to draw in that they may not have understood the Grinch, but they didn't. They kind of made his life miserable because they're like all the other Whos, but they never were outwardly hostile toward him the way that the mayor would be.
Mayhew, I think his name is.
Yeah, I think it's Augustus Mayhew or something like that. Mayor Mayhew. Ugh, it's a hard name to say. And it's this interesting kind of line is while there is humor in this, there's also the both Cindy Lou who has to confront the trauma of feeling different and the Grinch confronting the trauma of the past and not being able to like, not necessarily not reading the social cues, but not knowing how to navigate a world in which he's not just different because he's green, but he's different because he matures differently, has different thought processes. And there's a lot where you could easily see Cindy becoming like the Grinch if the Grinch weren't there, because it's obvious she is looking for something that she can't like identify with words, which is really cool.
You could almost argue there's a strong element of tragicomedy within this film, considering how it swings back and forth between the two different sides of theater.
Yeah, well, the Grinch's story is kind of tragic in a way. I mean, his only companion for a large portion of his life is Max, his dog. And Max is a fabulous character. Max is one of the better Susian side characters. I don't know. I can't recall if he ever gets his own story. But yeah, I mean, just to think about the Grinch as a character that you don't really get to see him eating in Mount Crumpet. Like his life is not full of things. He doesn't just live alone. He doesn't have things in both versions of this, because all the stuff in this live action Grinch movie that he has is all stuff that got left at the dump. It's all stuff that's discarded. If you see that long enough, the message in your brain becomes, I'm also discarded, and so I need to rebel so people will both leave me alone, but they will also know I'm still here. It's very much kind of wanting to be bothered and annoyed.
Yes. For some reason, the phrase, I am trash, and I'm proud of it, just screamed in my head for some reason. Which, in a sense, at times the Grinch does sort of embrace, almost as a rebellion against how this society has viewed him. I was considering before, like, we were talking about him being ostracized and a hermit outcast and such, and some real world examples are like the old in the old ages when we say witchcraft wasn't very well understood. Witches would live, or wise women would live, on the edges of community, still be a part of the community, but because they were misunderstood or not very well understood, they were like viewed differently by communities, part of it, but still ostracized. And I think you usually find within a lot of different cultures that there is usually different castes of outcasts that live within the fringes and such. But society kind of needs the outcasts to have those different perceptions and viewpoints.
And I would agree with that. Here especially you can see it because there is a sort of flatness to the world without the Grinch. Because it's so one note. Without the Grinch, the Whovilles are just people that count down to Christmas and that's all they do. I feel like Halloween Town, the Night Before Christmas, is different from that in that there's not as much flatness because everyone seems to scare in their own way, so they have things they can talk about. But like, if you look at the Cheermeister Festival without the Grinch there, There is something very kind of plastic and fake and shiny about it. The idea of, oh, the mayor is going to marry Martha May, who's the most beautiful in town, and he's going to get her a car, and he's going to be cheermeister, and no one's going to stand up against it because this is just kind of the tradition. Like, there's something kind of weird and flat to the world without the Grinch, but when the Grinch is there and kind of confronting, because I have trouble believing that the mayor wasn't just waiting for this to happen. I have no trouble believing that the mayor didn't have that electric razor just in the back somewhere to grab the second the Grinch came. Like, he knew exactly what he's gonna what he needed what was going to happen, and he knew exactly who to blame. He just needed a catalyst, and he got it, but he was prepared to re-traumatize someone to continue to get what he wanted, and to go back to that fake, shiny, non-confrontational world. And it's an interesting play on the idea of power, because even though the Grinch has a power within himself, he's there. There's something kind of gentle about him in a way. There's something that very much feels that loneliness, very much still has angerness and bitterness. There's something really interesting in that PTSD scene in Cheermeister, where everything is going really well and it's this really wonderful kind of fever dream, and you feel like the Grinch is starting to really feel it, after having like 14 dozen puddings. But like, the mayor's there to wreck it all down. Like, the people in power don't really want the other to have power themselves, because after the Cheermeister, if the Grinch is having a good time, what's to keep him from coming back into town? What's to keep him from taking Martha May away from the mayor? Because he's a more interesting person. He has more interesting things to say. He obviously has an attitude. It's just, as hard as that scene is, it's such an important scene for the movie, for Cindy Lou, for the Grinch. Like, it really does set up not just the second half of the movie, but it is sort of the statement of intent that I really love from Ron Howard. That we see in some of his other films. He knows how to do a statement of intent because he started out in the Twilight Zone. But specifically in this, you see the statement of intent at this Cheermeister festival. And I think it's very well done, even if it's very hard to watch.
Yes, sadly comes back to that point I mentioned before about the realism aspect of this film and the fact that, it's a good analogy for the fact that people in power do enjoy having a marginalized other or group to be their targets, to be who they can rally everyone behind their back. To be, on their side and what have you. It's interesting how quite a few films will, and narratives and stories, as soon as the hearts of the people are swayed and they realize, actually, this is who deserves our support, that really helps to, turn the situation around. I'm just thinking earlier in this year with Red, White, and Royal Blue, the conclusion by the fact that the couple had so much love and support from outside of their families, from so many people that were backing them, gave them the courage to sort of fly in the face of what was being demanded of them by the people in charge. And I feel that within this film, the mayor tries to rally the people at the end to still get rid of the Grinch and still blame Cindy Lou for what happened. But don't they pepper spray him to shut him up in the end?
I know that he gets the ring back from Martha May because she doesn't want anything to do with him. And they don't arrest the Grinch even though he wants it. I don't think he gets pepper sprayed, maybe. I think he just kind of has to go away. He just kind of has to slink away because Christmas is still gonna go on. And then of course they have that great kind of scene at the end where the Grinch comes back down the mountain with all their presents and stuff, and with Cindy Lou, and the moms kind of get together to like slow the sled so that people survive. There's something really great about kind of the end of it. The Grinch really doesn't want to go caroling, but the final scene before we go back to the narration of Anthony Hopkins and that great outshot like we have in the intro of them kind of going back out and showing the snowflake again, is really like he's annoyed about caroling, but he's not like he doesn't hate caroling. Like there's something interesting about the idea that it's really more the noise that bothers the Grinch more than it's the caroling itself. He's not like anti-Christmas per se. He's just kind of anti all the stuff that's going to end up in his dump. He's kind of anti the disingenuity of it all, saying, "Oh, we love Christmas," but really it's just a day to like give each other stuff. Because it's an interesting idea of the message of what Christmas is that we see a lot in such a saccharine form, and taking it and making it almost like aggressive and kind of steampunky and kind of mad scientisty in kind of the right context, in the right edit, you could easily turn this version of the Grinch into a horror film almost. Like it would be more like a Hitchcockian. It wouldn't really be like a people dying necessarily, but like there's an interesting idea of Grinch as horror villain in a different universe. But here, Grinch is not horror villain. Like Grinch has kind of the capacity to be who he is in any universe, but the way he interacts with people. Because in The Grinch versus the Cat in the Hat, he's kind of a downer, and he does not like the Cat in the Hat because the Cat in the Hat is way too optimistic. But like, at the end of the day, like no one's outright trying to murder each other that I could figure out. So.
Well, you say that didn't go into horror territory, but I thought you mentioned before that they had to remove a certain stuffed head from the Grinch's wall, which
Yeah,
you know
so
has
the
been
Cat in the
different.
Hat stuffed head on the Grinch's wall. I don't know what that was exactly about. It's also just hard to imagine that going well. I can see why that would need to be removed. But the Cat in the Hat, there's got to be more than one in the universe. I mean, there can't be just one sentient cat in a hat,
Well,
heading out.
it depends. We're gonna go into philosophical territory here. We know that the Grinches are a race. What if, like, the Cat in Hat is more of a metaphysical entity? There might just be one, but he can appear and reappear at any time he chooses, and he ends up being the foil to the grumpy Grinch race, shall we say?
I mean, I'd watch that. That'd be fun. Yeah, I would be happy with that.
And you mentioned about horror territory and such. It's way too early for this to happen, but the fact that we've seen now a Winnie the Pooh slasher horror movie in Blood and Honey after it went public domain, there's nothing to say that in the future, like, probably has to be like another 50 years, sadly, before that happens because of they need to wait until a certain time after Miss Dr. Seuss passing. But someone might well do that, you know.
Well, we've had quite famously there have been some really great Santa themed horror films. There was the Krampus film with Ben from Parks and Rec as the dad. So there is kind of this place for holiday horror fare. I do wonder if the Grinch is too obvious a choice to do holiday horror with. I do think there's something about the Grinch where in the right context you could go more into like the Kevin from Home Alone space where he would start setting traps, which I think would be kind of amusing. But it's the thing is that all of that is kind of depends on a catalyst. And so like again for the sequel, Because the Grinch is in a place where he's still a little kind of annoyed by Christmas, but he's become more kind and he has this community now. And so it's different when you go from being other to being part of the community. Now, there could be some PTSD, there could be things he has to learn to navigate, but if they set the movie, you know, 10, 20 years down the road, he's had that time to navigate that stuff.
Yeah.
And it may not all be done with. He may still feel like the urge to go off. He may get really angry and annoyed if the Whos don't continue with the idea of not buying each other so much stuff. But it's a very specialized, like, the Grinch has very specialized griefs and critiques about Christmas. Like, not everything is. Not everything is the end of the world for him. There's something about Christmas that I think he really does enjoy. Like money and rare Who roast beast, which who doesn't love a rare Who roast beast?
Indeed. And The Grinch came out in, I think it was 2001. There's been a lot of changes to Christmas in just those two intervening decades, but from when it came out to now. So if we were following on the themes of critiquing the popular vision of Christmas, I think there would actually be quite something to say. It could well be that the Whos have learned their lesson, and then all of a sudden some flashy outsider comes along who wows them all and almost starts luring them back into a materialistic side of Christmas because of all these very flashy gadgets and what have you. And yeah, then that would actually still fit within the themes of the other, but twisted on its head by another other who not necessarily has the best intentions at heart.
And that does work because the reason the Sneetches with the stars on their bellies and the Sneetches without the stars in their bellies, the reason they go through the process they go through is because of a guy with the machine that rolls up to their beach where the Sneetches are and promises one that they can make them look like the other and promises the other that they can look different. So they're always different. So there are Seussian lore is befit with people with wondrous weird machines. It's very Willy Wonka in that way, in a lot of ways. So that is an interesting idea for a premise for the sequel, is to bring in, you know, because there are people that want to do harm in the Seussian universe, unlike Willy, unlike the Roald Dahl universe, where unless they're out and outright evil, they're not doing like harm. Some people in the Seussian universe are just kind of out for a buck. So in the case of the Sneetches, it's that I almost say the mayor's kind of like that here. The mayor kind of wants his perfect life and he doesn't mind stepping on the Grinch to get it. Yeah. And what's interesting is that most of the town goes long because he does have power. Like even Cindy Lou, who's dad, doesn't really fight him on it until Cindy Lou's life has been in danger. And what's interesting is that he seems to be the only one in town that's really has the concept of power, because even the cop that goes to arrest the Grinch is like, but it's Christmas, I'm not going to arrest him. That's a really interesting thing, is that even the kind of police of this universe aren't really power hungry in a way. It's really just Jeffrey Tambor is the mayor, really.
Are very authoritarian.
Yes.
Yes. I suppose, again, another small theme might be the corruption of power and what you can do with that power to target someone, etc. But that's a bit of a universe. I suppose that's a bit more of a universal theme that you see. So I can't really attribute that too closely to just the Grinch, shall we say.
I think one interesting thing that I kind of want to end here with, because I just want people to experience the Grinch movie. If you haven't seen live action Grinch in a while, or you've just seen it on TV, I want you to pop in a DVD or find it on streaming so you don't have to watch ads with it, so you get the movie in one piece. But I want you to understand the concept of one thing they kept from the animated film and from the poem into this live action is they kept the concept of the Grinchian town Whoville small. It has this kind of very village hamlet feel. It is a very close-knit community of which the Grinch is very much other. He's not quite the same Grinch as the one that you see. There's only so much you can do because Susian logic is a little wiggly. But there's something really great about, they didn't need to make the town so big. It has a very Halloween town feel in a way, which I kind of like. Like, it's big enough to be big enough, but it's not any bigger than it needs to be. You get the idea of these people spending their whole lives together. And I do like that they never explain why Whoville is on a snowflake. That is a addition to this mythology that does not exist in the poem or the 60s animated special. And I kind of like they made those choices that could be really important, but could also just be Christmas magic. I think one thing about the 2023, 2024, whenever this movie comes out, if it does, is we've grown so used to the idea of all the things that we watch having an answer, or having like a reason behind it, and having all of this thought and having it be provoking. But sometimes, for a Christmas movie especially, there's not a problem with it being magical. For instance, the idea, Whoville is a small town that lives on a snowflake. I don't need to know where the snowflake goes or where it's coming from. And that's okay. That is a little thing that builds a world that doesn't harm anyone. It doesn't harm the story. And it's fun to have Anthony Hopkins read it. It's fun to watch the Grinch float into town on a bassinet. One thing we kind of get bogged down in is the idea of where is it all coming from? Where is it all going? And that just doesn't always work for films. And I think the Grinch needs a little bit of illusion magic in this case. It needs to be a little bit nonsensical in order to fit the world. And I think it does. This movie is great. This movie, there was a reason it was the second highest grossing holiday movie for many years. And it was something that people loved more than the movie experts. And that just happens every so often. I think Jim Carrey was the best casting choice for the Grinch. I'm glad he was able to get it together. I love what they did with the story. I love they turned a like 16, 18 page poem into a 2-hour movie. And I love that it's has all these themes of consumerism and environmental impact and other, and learning how to stand up to people in power and learning that people in power are always good. The style of it is great. Christine Baranski is sexy maid Martha Huvier is fabulous. And I'm sad I don't see that enough in holiday costumes. What can you do? If you haven't seen it in a while, it's a great family film. Pop in some popcorn, get yourself your favorite treat. Mine is chocolate covered cherries from Celia's, and yeah, have a great film night with it, because I think it's something that's a really nice family film to watch all together.
To sum up, it almost feels like you're saying that this could be viewed as a perfect adaptation of a Dr. Seuss book. Because it keeps all of the quirk, it keeps all of the imagination, but then also the meaning that the Doctor was trying to put into his stories, and encapsulates it perfectly in that medium.
Yeah, you can see a real major difference between how this went versus how 2003's Cat in the Hat went, not just because of how it was received by the public or how much money it made. But you can see within the story the difference between the techniques of Mike Myers and Jim Carrey. You can see that not only is it a different type of story, but the world that they work it in has two different, very different types of meanings. And I know that Cat in the Hat is kind of going through this thing where people are kind of falling in love with the live-action Cat in the Hat movie, which is a little weird, but, you know, it is what it is. But this movie is, I think, special in a much different way. And I'm really glad that Ron Howard was like, Yeah, I've got all the things you need in that Universal got it made. It's not quite on its 30th anniversary yet, but I'm anticipating there'll be a big to-do on the 30th because I think Universal, I don't remember which park Universal is, but there's some parks where they have like a Grinch Santa that you can like visit while you're at one of the theme parks, and that's a lot of fun.
Oh, well, it's been an absolute pleasure discussing one of your holiday favorites with you today, sir.
Yes, it's been a real pleasure. We have one more episode left to end season two. I can't believe it. Season two, it's almost in the can, as they say. We have one more
Shocking
episode
horror.
left. We're going to talk about a holiday trope from some of our favorite 90s sitcoms. I'm not going to tell you what the trope is. You'll just have to tune into it. And we will see you next time on Everything Is Gay, even the Straight Stuff Holiday Edition. It's a ho 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 from me, your American playwright, John McDonald.
And just a lovely singular ho from yours truly.
That's fabulous. Thank you, everyone, and I hope you have a great day.